wrap up week three of the new Buckmaster Show, I welcome you to the Buckmaster Show for Friday, January 21st, 2011. I am Bill Buckmaster on KJLL AM 1330, and we are always on the World Wide Web at buckmastershow.com, where all of the broadcasts from week 1, 2, and 3 are archived and very easy to retrieve. If you have a comment, story idea, or a question, email me at buckmastershow.com. On Fridays on the Buckmaster Show, it's the Friday Focus, where we bring in a newsmaker into our studios for questioning by myself and one of our reporters' roundtable regulars. This week it will be Mark Evans of TucsonCitizen.com. And this week the Friday Focus features the new superintendent of the state's second largest school district, the Tucson Unified School District. Dr. John Petticone in 2002 was named Arizona Superintendent of the Year for his work heading up the Flowing Wells School District. He began his new post as head of TUSD January the 1st. Dr. Petticone, thank you for being with us.
No, thanks, Bill.
And congratulations. How would you characterize the first 3 weeks on the job?
It's been an interesting ride. It's been I've learned a great number of things about the district, and some of the suspicions that I had before I got inside of the district were true, and some I found to be inaccurate. So it's been a real learning experience. We've begun to do some things, I think, to try to bring the system together so that we can begin to do the work that we've got to do. But it's been an interesting ride. The first board meeting that I ran, you may have remembered, we had some pretty significant interactions between community members. So, yeah, it's been fun.
What made you want to take this job? You'd had a very successful career at Flowing Wells. You were having a very successful career at U of A. Mm-hmm. Why jump back into what has historically been a career killer for superintendents?
Well, one of the reasons is I don't need a career. Okay. And I think I started out with that as a backdrop. I was approached by, when the last superintendent left, it was very clear that this district was really in trouble in terms of leadership. It was a two-year experience, and now they were facing a number of very, very difficult issues, the same ones that every other district in the state of Arizona and across the nation is facing, but with some additional distractors. And one of those things, of course, as everybody knows, is the ethnic studies issue. So I was approached by a community group. It was really across all constituency groups that said, we really would like you to consider this position. And my first reaction was the same as those that heard that I was considering this when they heard it, and that is, are you crazy? You know, like, right. And you can add your own expletives. But the person that made the phone call said, look, just think about it. Give it 24 hours. And it was interesting. I on my way home, and I thought about it. And I said, you know, we talk a lot about making change. I worked at the U of A for the past several years since I retired from Flowing Wells, and also for the Southern Arizona Leadership Council. And during that whole experience, we're looking at how can we make a difference in this community. And I felt like I've been nibbling around the edges a bit. And so kind of confronted myself to say, if you know, really want to make change, if you have an opportunity to do that, you should. And so I went home and talked to my wife, and we're married 34 years, a very patient woman. I said, you've got to do me a favor, talk me out of this, because I'm beginning to feel like this is something I've got to do. And that's really what inspired it and what it's become for me. It really has become this really remarkable opportunity, almost a mission to try to do something with some pretty remarkable people, by the way. One of the things I have learned is that we've got some really, really good people in this district. The issue is not them as much as it is the way in which we operate together. So that's why.
So putting ethnic studies aside, we'll get back to that, I'm sure. There's lots of questions to ask about that. But just in the district overall, what are those challenges, and what are you going to do to help get this district regain the respect that it had? Because for the longest time, TUSD was the best school district in the state. Mm-hmm. And it's fallen on a little harder times now. So what are those challenges, and what do you think needs to be done to get it turned around?
Now, let me answer that by giving you one example of exactly what you said and what's changed over time. When the district was formed in the early days, and I've had a chance to really look at the history of this district, it's a remarkable district in terms of its history and culture. It was really formed as a result of the diversity of the region. It was the first school district to be formed during the territorial days. Well, it was formed because we had Mexican families and what they called in those days American families really getting along in the region. And the district was important to the community leaders because they believed that that diversity, while really important, needed to be offered in terms of a public school system, needed to be wrapped around it, and they deserved a school system. So it really started from the very foundation of diversity and the wonderful nature of what happens when you have people that think differently, look differently, and perhaps act differently. How do you bring that together under one system? Well, then the concept in TUSD was small schools. And they were known for the neighborhood school. Build this capacity and build this alliance, allegiance and investment in a neighborhood school. And it was heroic in the early days. Well, times changed. There were the first largest district, Mesa, went the other way, by the way, and they went into this kind of almost like some people described it, a big box concept, and right. And they were in those days criticized for that way in which they built schools. Today they're heroic because the schools are efficient. In our case, the very thing that was the foundation of why we were so strong has turned out to be the thing that we simply can't support any longer. Right. So what it's come down for me to be is really about how do we take a look at what we were. Look at what we need to do in order to change, like any other good business model. Any organization has to look at that and adjust and make those adjustments without losing, by the way, the very strength of what is the foundation of the district. So that's where we're going. We're looking at systems. We're trying to determine when people say that the way you are most effective in this district is by working around the system, that says that the system's the problem, at least right. Part of it. So we're looking at that first, and then we're going to develop over time with our family of members, both inside and outside of this district. The culture that we need in order to be successful.
We're talking with John Pettacone. Dr. Pettacone is the new TUSD superintendent. I'm also joined in the studio here on the Buckmaster Show by Mark Evans. Mark heads up TucsonCitizen.com. Okay, now on to ethnic studies. You've been on the job about a month or so. What are your thoughts now on the program, and have the thoughts changed a bit since you've been on the job?
Yeah, my perspective on ethnic studies in TUSD has expanded, certainly. We have we actually have four ethnic studies programs, as you know, Mexican-American, which is the one that's under fire, Pan-Asian, Native American, and African-American. All of the other three ethnic studies programs really do advocacy, and they approach their work differently. The Mexican-American studies program took the position that in order to be able to make advances we need to with a very, very important population, they were going to look at it in terms of coursework. And what they did was developed a very innovative model that really brings kids together to teach the importance of resiliency, connection. It anchors them to a history, and it moves them forward to be able to understand how to use that to become, we believe, and the data, not only the data shows it, but if you meet and interview students that go through the program, successful citizens. What's happened with the program is it obviously has become a very, very political issue. I believe that the law that was implemented, and I think the district, when the law was being created, felt that they could very easily defend against it. And as I look at what's required in the law, I believe that to be true, not knowing any more about what's going to come forward when we go through the hearing piece that we're in right now. But I think that it does some very, very important things for our students. So for us and the district, and I'm very supportive of what the district position has been, ethnic studies is an important feature of what TUSD represents. And so we're going to defend it on that ground.
So opponents have made claims that the district has been hiding the course materials, that it's been manipulating the test data. And so have you personally reviewed the course materials and looked at the test data? Are you confident that absolutely the district is in compliance with 2281?
Yes. The answer is yes. I've got all the books in my office, and I've not read all of them from cover to cover, but I've looked through them. I understand the passages that are controversial. I also understand that that you cannot control what goes on in a classroom when a teacher implements a curriculum. It's the same with any course of studies that we look at in any school. So is it possible that some things have happened that we might prefer not have happened? Sure. I mean, it's very difficult on a case-by-case basis. But when I look at the data, and I have, we have a fairly significant assessment department in our district. I've asked to look at this data from a number of different positions. And in every case, what the claim of the program is true. That academic achievement for the students that are in that program increases both on AIMS in terms of graduation rate, in terms of entrance into college. All of those things are accurate. Are there passages and parts of material in the textbooks that are being used that anybody could look at and some would argue is not appropriate for high school students? The answer for me in that is probably yes. It isn't about, I can give you normal textbooks that are used in almost any course that if used improperly could be used for the same thing. In this case, it brings forward very, very difficult subject matter in a way that it does create controversy, and it's important to be transparent about that controversy. And then we expect teachers with responsibility to deal with it and lead students in the direction to understand that and use that to help them become exactly what we expect them to be, and that's successful citizens.
So then Tom Horn made a big show of presenting his evidence where he thought that the district was in violation of 2281, and then the superintendent of public instruction, John Hoopenthal, signed off on it. Have you looked at that evidence, and where do you think they've gone off the rails, where they're dead wrong?
Well, you know, as one of the ethnic studies teachers said when we brought them all together to talk about where we are as a district on this matter, they said, you know, there's 10 pages of documentation on the concern that Mr. Horn expressed. But of the 10 pages, everything in there is historical, and most of it took place a number of years ago. You have a teacher that felt very strongly that this was an inappropriate curriculum, and that's a matter for a subject for discussion. But clearly, if you look at what happened with the governing board on the 30th of December, we intentionally had a board meeting to make sure that the community knew we will not tolerate the things that are inherent in that law to take place in our schools. So from my perspective, The way in which this was done was not in the best interest of our students and certainly not in the best interest of our community. If we have those kinds of concerns, we sit down together, we examine what's going on, and then we make decisions about what is and what is not appropriate.
We're going to take a break right here. We're talking with Dr. John Petticone, and Mark Evans is here from TucsonCitizen.com. It's about 18 minutes past the hour. When we continue our discussion with Dr. Petticone, a little bit more on ethnic studies and some possible changes in the school day here in Arizona. We'll hear what Dr. Petticone has to say about that. Right after this, you're listening to The Buckmaster Show.
The Arizona Inn is the only Tucson hotel named by Travel and Leisure magazine as one of the top 500 hotels in the world for 2011. Located in Midtown, close to the University of Arizona, the Arizona Inn is located at 2200 East Elm Street and on the web at arizonainn.com. The Arizona Inn maintains AAA four diamond status for both the hotel and dining room, with Chef Allison serving up breakfast, lunch, and dinner daily, with a featured menu and seasonal favorites. And because the Arizona Inn is listed on the National Register of Historic Places, founded by Arizona's first Congresswoman, Isabella Greenway, the Arizona Inn provides an historic backdrop for your next special event. Arizona Inn is the perfect setting for weddings, anniversary celebrations, or your next business meeting, and you can make your reservations online at arizonainn.com. The Arizona Inn, luxury and elegance in the heart of Tucson.
Sarnoff Artist Materials is your one-stop store for fine and graphic artist supplies, framing, stationery, and Mont Blanc and other top-of-the-line writing instruments. Order online at sarnoffart.com or visit owner-operator Henry Sarnoff and his store staffed by artists, for artists, and those who seek the finest quality in everything art-related. Sarnoff Artist Materials, 2504 North Campbell, three blocks north of Grant, and always at sarnoffart.com.
Taste pizza as it was meant to be at Vero More, Tucson's only certified authentic Neapolitan pizza, topped with the finest, freshest quality ingredients. Enjoy casual yet upscale dining while sampling our extensive boutique wine list. Vero More in Tucson at North Swan and Camp Lowell, Dove Mountain in Marana, and on the web at VeroMorePizza.com. And coming soon, Noble Hops, Tucson's first gastro pub.
Up on 21 minutes past the hour. This is the Buckmaster Show. Dr. John Petticone is with us on our Friday Focus. He's the new superintendent of TUSD, and joining me here in studio at KJLL is Mark Evans from TucsonCitizen.com. Dr. Petticone, we've been talking about ethnic studies. We haven't brought up the penalty phase of all of this, which is hanging over you and your colleagues. I believe it would be about $15 million for TUSD. That would be the hit if you are found to be not in compliance over this ethnic studies issue.
Yes, sir, that's correct. If we right now we're in the 60-day hearing phase where the law was declared illegal, or the course was declared illegal, And so now we are we've moved forward with an appeal of that decision, and we will shortly go before a judicial hearing officer to make a decision on whether or not that is that in that judge's opinion it is true or not. The interesting part about the law is that even if the judicial hearing officer feels that we are in compliance and makes that recommendation to the current state superintendent, he has the right to ignore that opinion and move forward with whatever he feels is appropriate. The and so at the end of that, we will face, if we're not able to make a strong enough case, we will face the actual holding of up to $15 million. The interesting part of the law that concerns us is that this is the first law that I've been in the state for about since 1982 and served as superintendent, as you know, and worked with the Arizona School Administrators. I don't remember a law ever having the power that provides a unilateral, unbridled authority to one individual rather than having kind of a checks and balances process, where originally the law was supposed to be, I think, written to say state superintendent and state board. The word or was injected and introduced, and so now it is the state superintendent or the state board. So we really are at the mercy of whatever that decision is of that state superintendent.
One quick follow-up before I go back to you, Mark. Could this go to the U.S. Supreme Court, and do you expect that as a possibility?
Well, I think the answer to that is yes, it could. We are expecting, we have every confidence that we're going to be able to work with Mr. Hoopenthal, who I've met with already once and expect to meet with a number of times.
Did you have a friendly visit with him?
I really did. Yeah, I've known John Hoopenthal for a while, and I really do respect him. So I'm hopeful that we can work through this process and avoid that possibility. Yeah.
When I reviewed this law, I thought that the due process in it was farcical. I mean, you have the superintendent of public instruction has to rule whether you're in compliance or not. If he rules you're out of compliance, you get to go to an administrative law judge. Mm-hmm. If the administrative law judge says you're in compliance, they can go back to the superintendent, and then he can completely ignore that ruling and still find you out of compliance. That seems extraordinarily unfair, which would almost force you then, if the board is insists that you are in compliance and that the state is wrong, to go to court. So why not join the lawsuit that the teachers have already filed? What was the thinking, or what was your advice to the board about not just skipping this whole this process and going straight to court?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, it's our position and the position of our inside and outside counsel that without going through this process, our argument in favor of the next phase of this would be weakened. So it's important that we go through this process, attempt to get remedy, and then if we are unsuccessful, then we have a decision about whether we're going to move forward with the next stage, which would be to go to court and make our case. But without this process that we're going through right now, we believe that we would be weakened and perhaps be in a position not to be able to make a strong appeal.
All right. And how many students are we talking about here?
In the program?
In the Mexican-American studies.
We actually have some involvement across all levels, and if you include all of those students, about 2,200 students.
I want to move on to the school day. There's some conflicting information about how long a school day should be, or should we have almost year-round schools? Many countries have, year-round schools, but many folks probably picked up the Arizona Daily Star and saw on the front page today there's a move up at the state capitol now to perhaps not lengthen the school year, but to shorten it. Your opinion on that?
My opinion is that's a mistake. Everything that we know and everything that the research points out is that we need more contact time with students in classrooms, not less. You know, essentially, we have a number of Korean students that are visiting us through our Pan Asian program, a really, really wonderful group of kids and families. And we were at the first meeting with them, and we were talking about what their system looks like. Their system looks something like this. It's 6 days a week from 7 o'clock in the morning until 9 o'clock at night. There's this tremendous cultural emphasis on education. In this country, we just, as you know, through Prop 301, managed to get 5 more days to bring us to 180. We're still well behind, and then we look at our relationship in terms of how our students do and perform across nations, and we wonder why. There's a lot of factors that enter into it, and certainly teacher contact time with quality teachers is one of them.
So what's the motivation, do you think, from some lawmakers to go the other way?
Well, I mean, I think it's economic. They're looking at some tremendous, and I really do understand that the economic burden placed on the state is tremendous. We need to look at that from a overall perspective, and what's happening is that there's kind of a patch quilt of solutions that are being suggested, and this is one of them. So I just think it's wrong, and with the best of intentions on the part of some people that are suggesting it, I know some of those people, it's just not a good idea.
Go back to the point that you'd made earlier, kind of overviewing why you took the job. You talked about the district early on wanted to have small schools and neighborhood schools. So the district ended up now, about 4 years ago, I think there were about 57,000 students. I think it's much less than that now. I think you're down to like 54, 53?
Yeah, about 53 and a half.
Okay. But you had, I think, upwards of 100 schools. Mm-hmm. And so the district has been trying to consolidate those, and that's been a very painful process, especially for the parents who have their kids in those schools that are maybe have been identified for closure. Will that process continue? Do we still need to consolidate and get those facilities reduced? And you also got authority from the voters with Prop 403-4 to sell off some properties. Where does that money go if you're successful in selling any number of those?
Yeah, what the authority gave us was the right to be able to use the dollars that are recaptured from any sale, a lease, or whatever, into our capital funds to do other things in the district that would help us to offset some of the losses that we've had. But so the answer to your first part of the question is yes, that process is still continuing to examine whether or not we need to close more schools, and if so, the important part about that is where, and then an additionally important part about that is what do we do with them, the disposition of those properties once they are closed or compressed or consolidated. We have a study going on right now where we are looking at an overall strategic facilities plan to try to identify for the future a long-term vision about where we believe growth is going to take place, where growth is going to be reduced, and some of the factors that have an impact on how we've gotten to the point that we're at right now. So when we see the results of that study, which will be by the middle of February, we'll have a better idea about what it looks like for this year. I'm inclined to say that if we're going to do this with the degree of integrity for our community, we need a significant process that gets their input and makes them well aware of any of these decisions early on so that we don't end up in the situation we've ended up before with some of the closure issues.
We've got less than 2 minutes to go. Give us a quick overview on TUSD's financial picture as we enter into the calendar year of 2011.
Well, we're hopeful, depending on what happens at the legislature. We've seen the governor's plan for how we not only deal with this year's budget, but also the budget for 11-12. If that plan goes through, we will be able probably to manage without a great deal of additional adjustments, we're hopeful. But if it doesn't, and there are some other legislative suggestions that might make it very, very difficult for us, we're going to have to look at the same thing we've looked at in the past, and that is, where do we make these cuts? And we already have made cuts, significant cuts, at the administrative level. We're now looking at what happens in schools with regard to class size and programs that we believe are really important. So, like every other district, we're waiting.
When Selena Fagan left, she took some of her staff with her. Are you in the process of replacing those people, and is that going to end up becoming a cost to the district?
Yeah. It will cost the district, although it will probably be less money. We're going to look at a little different model, for example, in legal at this point. But that was a very, very that was very difficult. We lost finance and law. Right. Try two more stakes in the heart. But we posted those positions. We are now in the process of identifying candidates, and so we'll move forward with that.
Dr. John Petticone has been our guest on Friday Focus on the Buckmaster Show. Mark Evans has joined me in the questioning. Mark will stick around, and we'll continue with our Friday Radio Roundtable, Reporters Roundtable. It's coming up after this break on CNN.
Local talk at its best.
Real talk is what this is.
AM 1330, KJLL, South Tucson.
CNN Radio, I'm Bill Caiaccio. Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords has just left a hospital in Tucson, Arizona. The next stop on her road to recovery is Houston, Texas. A team of specialists there will treat the gunshot wound to her brain. Dr. Dong Kim will be part of that team.
We have to think of things like, you know, are there infections to worry about? Are there fluid problems? How's the wound healing?
Wisconsin Congressman Paul Ryan, who's considered a rising star in the party, will deliver the GOP's response to President Obama's State of the Union speech next Tuesday. There's a meeting going on in Turkey to talk about Iran's nuclear program. It includes diplomats from Iran, the U.S., Russia, China, and Europe. Not a lot of people think the U.S. economy is in good shape. A CNN opinion research poll found 24% give the economy a thumbs up, but that is up 6 points from November. The most trusted name in news. This is CNN Radio.
My heartburn was like a pilot light in my chest. I never knew when it would flare up. Until I found Zegrid OTC, the only 24-hour frequent heartburn treatment with two active ingredients, a prescription-strength acid blocker, plus an ingredient that protects the medicine from stomach acid. Just one Zegrid OTC capsule a day controlled my pilot light. So if yours keeps flaring up, try dual-ingredient Zegrid OTC.
Use as directed for 14 days to treat frequent heartburn. Go to ZegridOTC.com for coupon savings.
All right, sir, your new tires are all installed.
And how much do I owe you?
Let's see, 4 all-weather radials plus balance, alignment, and labor brings your total to $0.
Did you say zero?
Yep, it's free.
Thank you. From the bottom of my wallet.
Free is better. Do your simple federal return for free at TurboTax.com. It's free to prepare, free to print, and free to e-file. No wonder TurboTax is the most trusted brand of tax software in America. Visit TurboTax.com today. Trusted brand claim based on Intuit Commission survey, August 2010.
Listed on the National Register of Historic Places and founded by Isabella Greenway, Arizona's first congresswoman, the Arizona Inn is still the standard bearer for luxury hospitality in Midtown Tucson, just minutes from the University of Arizona. Founded in 1930, the Arizona Inn continues to win top honors for hospitality and dining. Travel and Leisure magazine names the Arizona Inn one of the top 500 hotels in the world for 2011. And the Arizona Inn is proud of its AAA four diamond status for both the hotel and dining room. Whether it's for breakfast, lunch, or dinner, or a private event, you can count on Chef Allison's featured seasonal culinary creations to please. The Arizona Inn, a special oasis of hospitality in Midtown Tucson, 2200 East Elm, and on the web at arizonainn.com.
Hi, I'm Mark Sublett, owner of Medicine Man Gallery, and I'd like to invite you to come visit me. Medicine Man Gallery is located at 7000 East Tancredi, at the southwest corner of Tancredi and Sabino Canyon, and online at medicinemangallery.com. With 12,000 square feet of exhibit space, we have a wide array of American paintings, antique Indian art, and contemporary modern art by some of the masters of the West, including Ed Mell, John Moyers, and Maynard Dixon. If you have old Indian art or American paintings you'd like to sell or consign, call me for a free evaluation, as we're always looking to add to our collection. If you can't visit us on Tancredi, then visit us online. We have over 6,000 objects to view at medicinemangallery.com. So come visit me, Mark Sublett, at Medicine Man Gallery, on the corner of Tancredi and Sabino Canyon, where there's always something new to see.
Welcome back to the Buckmaster Show on KJLL AM 1330 and on the World Wide Web anytime, anywhere, buckmastershow.com. It's time for our Friday Radio Roundtable. Joining me on the Friday Roundtable, Sarah Garrett Gasson is here from the Arizona Daily Star, Mark Evans, TucsonCitizen.com, and John C. Scott, host of Tucson's most popular political radio talk show, joins us as well. And that show, of course, is every weekday from 3 to 5 in the afternoon. John, let's begin with you. How has the coverage kind of changed? How was your week on the John C. Scott Show as far as the Gabrielle Giffords story?
Well, I think the intensity has been centered around her health and her trip now as national television shows, the ambulance pulling away from UMC on the way to the airport to take her to Houston. So I think a lot of people are now, in fact, you know, wondering how long her recovery might take. Incredible rhetoric from across the country, some people calling for her resignation, insanity. I mean, it's beyond the pale that people would start that now. But, of course, that's not going to happen, and everybody's praying for her recovery. And it's going to be a long trudge, I think. It's going to be a long time before we really know how capable the congresswoman is. But Mark Kelly obviously said she's going to be back. And I don't... Yeah, I think she'll walk back into the Capitol. You know,
talking full recovery are the words that he used. I mean,
well, he must know as much as, if not more than almost anyone else. That would be a wonderful thing.
It would indeed be wonderful. I think it's going to be hard for people who care so much about Gabby Giffords to not get their hopes up too high, because any sort of brain injury, I mean, we have to be realistic, is just a long, long road. But of course, so many of us wish her well and hope for a great recovery. I think you're right that the coverage has been focused now on more the health, the medical, and then it's going to be interesting to see how the era of civility, if you can call it that, continues.
Has that ended yet, or did that last?
It was on the History Channel.
Yeah. Was it? Did it last 30 seconds or so?
I think it may have. The letters to the editor and comments, it's not exactly all friendly. But I think also we have to be aware that we can't, people are talking about healing and closure, and I think that's something that is very individual, and that we can't assume that, oh, she's going on to Houston, it's all going to be okay from now on.
And in terms of the era of civility, I've always been, you know, put at arm's reach the fringe element that like to send letters to the editor or write comments on newspaper websites and say things simply to be inflame and incite. They're a small percentage, and they like to do that just to get a rise out of people. Where the era civility really needs to occur needs to be in our halls of government and in the public discourse between Republicans and Democrats in the House or in the Congress, and then also in our own state, in the legislature, and in Pima County. And, you know, you can criticize the sheriff for his comments made just hours after the shooting, but to have people from Utah, you know, trying to talk about recalling him and then coming down here and then the Tucson Tea Party Patriots having a protest, that's pointless, and that's really not what we need at this point.
And also, I think the idea that now we're getting into, if you disagree with someone, then you're not being civil and it's hate speech. I think we need to, there's a very fine line that needs to be walked between people understanding that it's not, criticizing is not hate speech, and right, it's not a personal attack.
We're going to check in with Jim Nintzel, the Tucson Weekly. Jim has been covering the big morning activities over for Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords, who's being moved at this hour from University Medical Center to Houston, one of the top brain injury facilities in the country. Jim, what's the scene like out there?
Well, you had a pretty large crowd of folks gathered on the sidewalks along Cherry Avenue, where the Congresswoman departed the hospital, and I spoke with a couple of the VFW motorcycle riders who were escorting her, and they were saying that it was very important for them to be there for Gabby, because they felt that Gabby had been there for them and for the military in the past, and they thought it was an honor to be able to escort this. And I think a lot of folks are turning out along the route to say goodbye to Congresswoman Giffords as she leaves her home for a time, and I think we're all hoping she'll be back before too long.
Jim, do you want to jump in on our discussion here about civility? We were just kind of saying maybe it only lasted 30 seconds. Is there a change in tone? Is it continuing?
Well, I think it really remains to be seen exactly how, whether or not we're going to see a real shift in that, and I think a lot will depend on what the voters reward. If the voters support candidates ultimately that keep it within bounds and stick with talking about where they disagree on issues, then yeah, it will be successful. But if voters continue to support the most outrageous candidates in primaries, then no, it's not going to last.
Well, maybe civility may be like pornography. You know, you can't define it, but you know it when you see it. You know, but I think a lot of people are right back to where they were, Jim. You know, they feel so strongly about these political issues that, you know, they're going right back to where they were. I think the tone may be, maybe the decibel level will be a little lower, but I think the rhetoric will be the same. Hard to have these politicians change their stripes on both sides, so I think we're just going to see it ratcheted up the further away we get from the tragedy.
And I think the real problem is, you know, there's all the rhetoric on the campaign trail. We saw it here in Congressional District 8 where Jesse Kelly was saying things like, I hope there are no liberals left when I get to Congress, and comments like that make it very difficult to actually work with the other side once you're in office. And I think we're approaching a point where it's becoming increasingly difficult to actually govern the United States of America or the state of Arizona, because you have people who are so absolutely determined to do things only their way, and so we're running into a situation where the old ways of politicians being able to actually find some kind of middle ground between them and reach some sort of compromise are fading into memory.
Jim, we're going to let you go. Thank you for checking in with us.
All right. We'll see you soon, Bill.
Okay. I want to turn this discussion to the health care cuts at the Capitol and the governor's budget that she has released on education, health care, and some other issues. Mark Evans from TucsonCitizen.com, you want to begin with the health care cuts that are being proposed?
Right. So a few years ago, the voters passed a law that increased enrollment in the state health care and the Medicaid, or our access program, and pegged the funding to tobacco tax. Well, the tax hasn't even come close, or the tobacco settlement, one or the other, that hasn't even come close to paying for the increase in the enrollment. And so the legislature wants to roll back that increase. And that affects almost 300,000 people. And to tell 300,000 people, guess what, you don't get into health insurance anymore, considering the economic times and how hard it is to get a job, and 10% of Arizonans are unemployed, and another 5 to 6% above that are underemployed, meaning they lost their jobs and found a job that paid them less or was part-time, it's just an outrage. It's the wrong thing to be doing. I understand the problem that the state is in with its budget, but throwing people out of their doctor's offices is wrong.
And I have to say that as the U.S. House votes to repeal the what they divisively call Obamacare, which other people call Obamacares, but as they're trying to repeal that, there are things that are showing that it's working. Even in among people I know, there's friends who have adult children who are under 26 who've been able to move those children who are adults from access because they don't make enough on their own to qualify for health insurance, from access back to the parent's plan. So it's this sort of interconnected web of federal and state situations that's very fluid, and I think I totally agree with Mark. It's might be penny wise, but it's pound foolish.
And John, as you know, on the Buckmaster Show this week, we had Dr. James Dahlin, the former, he is the Dean Emeritus at the U of A College of Medicine, and he was talking about we are going to have our emergency rooms swamped because these people are so sick they can't get any kind of care.
I think there's got to be additional revenue for the state. Somebody, a Democrat, more than likely is going to have to stand up and say, look, you know, we're going to have to increase the revenue. And, of course, when voters were given the option to do that, they did that in overwhelming numbers almost in every county of the state. I don't think the people of Arizona want to see the infrastructure of the state crumble. I don't think they want to see those emergency rooms standing room only. I don't think they want to see their universities fall into a third world class higher institution of learning. I don't think the people of Arizona, when the people of Arizona were given their vote, they did the right thing. When the legislature of Arizona has the power, they seemingly have done the wrong thing. But it's got to go back to the people of Arizona. It is our state. It may be controlled by Republicans, but it belongs to the people of Arizona. And they must be given a chance to speak in these very difficult times. And were they to do so, I think they would speak with a resounding vote of some sacrifice on everybody's part to save the state from what appears to be a, you know, on the edge of a very severe precipice. And, you know, we're all supposed to hold hands and jump here. And I'm not so sure everybody wants to either hold hands. Most of us don't want to jump.
That's for sure.
The Morrison Institute at ASU, along with another think tank at UNLV, had a report on Arizona's budget problems last month. And that report showed that Arizona had a structural problem with the way it does its budget. And it is not a revenue problem, and it is not a spending problem. It's both. It's also a propositions problem, because the voters have tied the legislators' hands. There's billions of dollars that can't be touched when you get into a fiscal crisis up in the legislature. And Lattie Kaur, Sandra Day O'Connor, they both had ad hoc committees that have recommended a complete overhaul the way the state does its budget, rather than this one-off tinkering that we've been going through the last 3 years by the legislature. This legislature must fundamentally redraw how this state does its budget, because from year in and year out, we are going to be in this situation until they do that.
You know, Steve Land said something amazing to me, head of the Redistricting Commission, vice president of Unisource. He said every time Napolitano wanted something, the Republicans gave it to her as long as she was willing to go along with a tax cut. If you want all-day kindergarten, you can have it, but we want a tax cut. So that was almost insanity, because you're increasing the services to the state, and you're also reducing the revenue to the state. And that went on and on and on. I mean, she did get along with Republicans, but once she got something, she gave them something, which was always a tax cut. And that, I hadn't ever heard it put that way, but it makes a lot of sense as to how we got here. So.
This is the Friday Roundtable, Radio Roundtable on KJLL, the Buckmaster Show. We have Sarah Garrett Gasson with us from the Arizona Daily Star, Mark Evans from TucsonCitizen.com, and of course, John C. Scott has been with us. John had to step away, but I want to now go to Sarah. The governor's budget plan, some of these cuts to higher education have Pima Community College for one, and I interviewed Chancellor Flores here on the Buckmaster Show. We were talking with him on Monday, I believe, and he's talking that this is a huge cut. State funds are basically drying up for community colleges.
Yeah, and if you look at where people who have lost their jobs turn to in a time of transition, they go back to job training or go back to community college. And so their enrollment is just growing and growing and growing. And the way they turn to students for tuition, property tax increases, perhaps, there are limited ways to go and get more money. So as the state cuts back, if the college is still going to be able to serve the people it has been serving, which is a very affordable way if you're coming out of high school to get a couple years, get your basic stuff in before you go to the more expensive university. And from what I hear from a lot of students, it's a lot more personal option. The way to continue that job training and economic force is to keep those engines going. And if the state cuts back, that money has to come from somewhere, and that's going to be property tax, and that's going to be students. And I wanted to get back, if I could, just for a moment, to the health care. We talk about these 300,000 people who are going to be kicked off. Every one of those people has a family, has neighbors, has perhaps a job. It's really easy to talk in these big terms, and perhaps the legislature is kind of detached because they're not there when these people who are still going to get sick show up in the emergency rooms and need health care. It's not like you don't have insurance, so therefore you're in perfect health. It just doesn't work that way. So I think if there is a way for the lawmakers to understand individually that each of these people has a life and has a value to the state and something to contribute, that until you see the personal side of these cuts, it's just numbers, and it's maybe perhaps easier than it should be.
And along those lines, it's the same thing for the students of Arizona who want to get higher education. These effects on education have effects in almost every household in Arizona with young children. My daughter is a junior in high school. When she was in eighth grade or seventh grade, we were looking at her finances, and when her grandfather passed, we were benefited from his estate, and she has some money to go to college. And we were looking at how much money she had. It was about, when she graduated from high school, it was going to be about $50,000. And that was going to be enough for her to go to U of A and for 4 or 5 years and cover her books and her tuition and everything. Well, now it's not. And it looks like now there's going to be another tuition increase and more tuition increases on that. So she's now looking at where she's going to have to borrow money to go to college. And that's not what we're supposed to be about in Arizona. We're supposed to be about nearly as free as possible. It's in our Constitution for our higher education. So the legislature trying to balance the books on the backs of college students because the universities can simply keep raising tuitions, there's a price to be paid for that. It's not free.
And the notion that that I think some lawmakers have, that the state should have no business in public education for higher education because it's the individual who benefits throughout the course of their life.
You hear that a lot.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense because people who earn more money pay more in taxes. It just doesn't make any sense in any way, because if you increase your education, your quality of life, it affects everyone around you.
We're going to have to say goodbye. Mark Evans from TucsonCitizen.com. Thank you for joining me for the Friday Focus with Dr. John Pettacone.
My pleasure.
A nice conversation. I think we learned some things from Dr. Pettacone and Sarah Garrett Gasson from the Arizona Daily Star. Always a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And before we take the break, the Buckmaster Show is brought to you in part by Flowers, Rieger & Associates Certified Public Accountants. They're at 2919 East Broadway and on the web at flowersrieger.com. Flowers & Rieger is the CPA firm of the Buckmaster Show. Weekend Watch with Matt Russell is coming up next. What's going on this weekend here in Tucson?
Sarnoff Artist Materials is Tucson's award-winning destination for everything art-related, including fine and graphic artist supplies, framing, stationery, and the world's best writing instruments. Visit owner-operator artist Henry Sarnoff at 2504 North Campbell, 3 blocks north of Grant, and always at the easy-to-navigate website, sarnoffart.com. Because it takes an artist to know an artist's needs.
Vero Amore presents Tucson's only certified authentic Neapolitan pizza using fresh homemade mozzarella and the finest quality toppings. Taste pizza as it was meant to be at Vero Amore, casual yet upscale dining with an extensive boutique wine list. Vero Amore in Tucson at North Swan and Cap Lowell, Dove Mountain in Marana, and on the web at veroamorepizza.com. Coming soon, Noble Hops, Tucson's first gastro pub.
Hi, I'm Mark Sublett, owner of Medicine Man Gallery, and I'd like to invite you to come visit me. Medicine Man Gallery is located at 7000 East Tancredi, at the southwest corner of Tancredi and Sabino Canyon, and online at medicinemangallery.com. With 12,000 square feet of exhibit space, we have a wide array of American paintings, antique Indian art, and contemporary modern art by some of the masters of the West, including Ed Mell, John Moyers, and Maynard Dixon. If you have old Indian art or American paintings you'd like to sell or consign, call me for a free evaluation, as we're always looking to add to our collection. If you can't visit us on Tancredi, then visit us online. We have over 6,000 objects to view at medicinemangallery.com. So come visit me, Mark Sublett, at Medicine Man Gallery, on the corner of Tancredi and Sabino Canyon, where there's always something new to see.
That is the signature music for Weekend Watch on the Buckmaster Show each Friday morning, as we're joined by Matt Russell, host of the weekly radio show On the Menu Live, which airs Thursday afternoons at 5 right here on KJLL. Matt, welcome again to the Buckmaster Show.
Nice to be with you again, Bill, as always.
What should I and our listeners be looking for in terms of wanting to get out, do something kind of different, maybe in the downtown area?
Yeah, you bet. Downtown is going to come alive this weekend, Bill, actually starting tonight at about 6 o'clock to commemorate this annual Dillinger Days event that they have. Of course, Notorious Bank Robber and Gangster John Dillinger captured at the Hotel Congress, which really, I think, for the first time put Tucson on the map. So beginning tonight, down at the Hotel Congress at 6 o'clock, is this great sort of swing, swank party with the Kings of Pleasure. Aaron DeFeo, the bar manager, is going to be mixing up some Dillinger sidecars, some martinis, and other great retro cocktails. And that's a lot of fun tonight.
1930-ish.
If we
They've kind of toned down in respect to the Tucson tragedy. Not a lot of gunplay will be expected
exactly.
For the Dillinger Days this
For the
year.
Dillinger Days on Saturday, for the reenactment and all of that, this is going to be absent any gunfire at all. So I think that's sort of a nice tribute. But also, we want to reinforce, this is a family event on Saturday. I've been taking my own kids down to Dillinger Days for years, and it's always something to which we look forward.
I love the old cars.
Yeah, the old vintage car show they have.
So cool.
They're going to be showing showing Public Enemy, the movie, at the Fox Theater, I think, at 1 o'clock on Saturday.
Love those old movies.
And the fun goes well into the evening with an authentic speakeasy on Saturday night starting at about 6 o'clock. So this is a great event for downtown Tucson and really for the whole community.
Let's talk food.
Yes, indeed. Food. Well, you know, coming up on this edition of On the Menu Live on Thursday, we're going to be talking to Daryl Wong of Lotus Garden Restaurant, which, as I understand it, is the oldest family-run Chinese restaurant in Tucson. We're going to kind of get the difference between Cantonese style, Sichuan style. They do them both there at the Lotus Garden, but we're going to be asking the tough questions, Bill, about what do people expect when they demand authentic Chinese cuisine. We're going to be talking to Daryl on the show next Thursday at 5.
And Rick over there at the Hungry Fox, over there at Broadway and Swan. Rick, I have not forgotten about you. Jim Nintzel, 2 weeks ago, Jim and I went over there for breakfast, and Rick said, Bill, you forgot to mention when you're talking about breakfast places with Matt that we do breakfast 24/7.
Yeah, and you know what they do? They've got these great eggs. Be careful. Don't order 2 eggs because you're going to get 4. They're double yolk eggs. I've never seen anything like this.
Huge portion. What I love about Tucson, one of the many things is, and you, of course, do this every week and on the Menu Live, the variety of food in this town. It's amazing.
Yeah, absolutely.
From Afghan food to food from Zimbabwe, you can get it A to Z here in this town.
That's the reason why Tucson is the culinary capital of the Southwest, and it's something we celebrate each and every week here.
And what is any hot restaurant news that you want to tell us about this week on Weekend Watch?
You know, there's a restaurant, speaking of downtown, keeping in that theme, there's a restaurant that's going to be opening up just in a couple of weeks called The Hub Downtown, specializing in, get this, quality meats, organic ice cream, and 24 beers on tap. They're doing some great things. Also, quickly, Romero Scavo, the former executive chef for the Hacienda del Sol, Zona 78, and Harvest, has gone out on his own. He's going to be opening up Pasco Kitchen and Lounge just in a couple of weeks down in Main Gate Square on University between Park and Euclid. Urban farm food. What does that mean? We'll have to go check out Pasco Kitchen and Lounge and tell you exactly what's up.
Would you mind if I give a plug to a couple of my sponsors?
Absolutely.
Vero Amore Pizza.
Oh, my goodness.
I mean, such good pizza over there at Swan and Camp Lowell and at Dove Mountain. And then they've got this new kind of gastro pub concept.
Noble Hops.
Yeah,
I can't
Noble
wait.
Hops is coming online. And, of course, the Arizona Inn, one of our wonderful sponsors. What can you say if you want a wonderful lunch or dinner? And of course, they do breakfast too. There,
my favorite weekday lunch and breakfast at the Arizona Inn, the place to sort of see and be seen. If you're not taking a client to lunch at the Arizona Inn, I can almost guarantee you, you're going to leave with a client, because this is the place where power, the centerpiece, the epicenter of power in Southern Arizona, at the Arizona Inn.
It's where Tucson does business. Matt Russell, there comes your theme music. We're going to have to say goodbye. Thanks. Have a great weekend.
You do the same, Bill. Thanks.
Thank you. And I want to remind you that the Buckmaster Show is a production of Bill Buckmaster Communications, LLC. On behalf of Team Buckmaster, our producer, Rosemary Brandt, and our marketing director, Deborah Howard, I am Bill Buckmaster, wishing you a wonderful and a very safe weekend. We've got a great lineup for you coming up next week on the Buckmaster Show. Lots of newsmakers. And this is where it's happening. You want to be well informed? This is Intelligent Talk. And we've got it for you here on KJLL, The Jolt, AM 1330. And please, check out our website. We are very excited about it. 24/7. Click on any of the shows from the first 3 weeks. It's there for you instantaneously. Have a great weekend.
KJLL, South Tucson.